Good morning. Welcome. Our first case is case number A19-1298, Casey Darkenwald, respondent versus Thomas Darkenwald. It looks like attorneys are prepared, and the only opening remarks I have is that when you do approach the podium, if you'd settle in and make sure that the microphone stand is adjusted so that we can hear you clearly through the microphones, and state your name before you begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Cliff Anderson, and I represent the appellant, Thomas Darkenwald. This appeal raises many important questions, but the two most important, which I'm going to focus on in my limited time today, are first, was the Wright County's jury verdict contrary to Minnesota law, such that if this court upholds this verdict, it will negatively change Minnesota law against public policy that generally upholds estate plans absent very extraordinary circumstances, such as incapacity and undue influence? The answer in this case is this verdict was contrary to Minnesota law. Simply put, the trial court did not exercise its gatekeeping function under Rules 50 and 59 of the Minnesota Rules of Civil Procedure to correct this verdict. This court is an error-correcting court, and an important distinction that this court has to keep in mind is these cases most often come up through a bench trial. And in a bench trial, the court has a dual role, finder of fact, and to ensure a verdict is in compliance with Minnesota law. Here we have the unusual situation, because the parties did stipulate to a jury trial, that this case has essentially bifurcation. The jury is the fact finder, but the court has a gatekeeping function to ensure that whatever facts they find are logical, rational, and make sense under Minnesota law. And that did not happen here. The second issue that I'm going to address is—
Well, before you move to the second issue, sure. Maybe you can clarify, what is the Minnesota law that you're saying the verdict was contrary to?
Sure, absolutely, Your Honor. Particularly cited in our reply brief, but also in our opening brief at the last footnote. The way I'd like the court to think about this case is really three key dates that'll help organize the facts and answer your question, Your Honor. If we focus on July 26th of 2013, which, as we all know, is the key date in this record, when Billy Darkenwald disinherited her son John and his children and made a new will, that's one date to keep in mind. The next date to keep in mind is December of 2014, when Billy Darkenwald went into Wellstead assisted living at about 94 years and 10 months. And then finally, September of 2015, when she was in Wellstead, and evidence is she was in the throes of severe dementia psychosis. Your Honor, if you look at the cases of In re Estate of Torgerson, Ristow, Reichsteigel, Hausker, for example, and look at those set of facts. They have facts such as the individual met with counsel multiple times. Yes, they may have had some level of dementia. For example, in Ray Condon, Ms. Condon from the famous Duluth murder trial, she had a stroke, couldn't even speak, and she was allowed to amend her will. Those are the type
right,
of cases.
Right, but that case is different, though, because that stroke did not affect her mental capacity in that case.
That is true, Your Honor, but I would also argue, if we look at the record here, as you're well familiar, Ms. Darkenwald testified for 3 hours in a deposition. Think about the notion of an individual, any individual, age 30, age 93, testifying in a deposition for 3 hours. Is that consistent with utter incapacity and undue influence, someone puppet on a string telling her how to answer questions all day long? That deposition occurred literally within 6 weeks of the key decision. And so,
right, but you do have an issue of that in that deposition. A lot of the questions were yes and no questions that were asked, and there's testimony from both doctors who said that somebody with dementia can answer yes and no questions and will actually answer them in a way that appears that they are competent, when in fact what they're doing is trying to show that they understand the questions even if they don't.
I will answer that question, Your Honor, with due all due respect, I'll disagree in this respect, and I do want to finish the Judge Bryan's question, which is, what about case law at the other extreme? So let me finish that piece, and I'll answer your question, which...
You can take mine out of order. I think since we're on this,
yep.
this topic, maybe you, yep. you can address Judge Reyes's question.
So let's look at specific questions that were asked of Billy Darkenwald in her deposition, and you evaluate whether these are yes or no questions. She was asked, is there anyone that told you what you should say today? She says, no, just tell the truth, tell what I know. She's asked,
That sounds like a yes or no question, right?
Well,
it's a yes or no question.
Well, that's yes or no. That's fair. Is your son John supposed to get any of the money in your trust? No, he's had his money. He doesn't need it.
Yes or no question again.
Well, sure, but she's expanding on it. It's not a no or a yes and only that with no color or elaboration. When she's asked, is that something that changed recently? She says, well, I always know. This was a long time I thought about this. He doesn't need what I've got. Yeah, I was disappointed in John because he was taking money. And there's rational explanation for this.
Fair enough. There is rational explanation, but the jury didn't buy that testimony. Well, and we deferred to the jury's fact-finding role.
Well, that's true to a point, Your Honor. But if we take it to its logical extreme, the Court of Appeals would never reverse a jury verdict. And Rules 50 and 59 are there for a purpose. They're there to correct errors. And so we have to remember that,
So I think that brings us back to Judge Bryan's question. Where is the error then?
What is the law that you're saying the jury applied, the wrong law that they applied?
Well, I'm not saying that the jury applied the law wrong. The jury was instructed on the law, which was generally right, although, as you know, we have two or three additional points. We felt the court should have given an additional instruction about the ubiquitous puppet on a string language, which is in all these cases, and instructions
regarding... Well, it's not adopted in the later cases. It's in the earlier cases, but not in the later cases.
You see it less. I would agree with that. But leaving that aside for a moment to address what's the error of law, the jury found facts that... When you look at the cases that I listed off, Your Honor, that are comparable to July 26th of 2013, those types of cases show individuals going to their trust and estates lawyer two or three times, deliberating, making a careful decision. When you look at the cases such as In Re Estate of Anderson, In Re Estate of Anthony, In Re Estate of Horton, those are examples where the individual is in the throes of serious dementia, more equivalent to that date, December of 2014 or September of 15, when Billy was in Wellstat. And we have to look at the specific facts around when Billy made this decision. And here's a really important point that I don't want the court to lose sight of. A couple other important dates to keep in mind. Casey Darkenwald testifies that Billy Darkenwald was being unduly influenced by Tom Darkenwald as early as 2006 or 7. By 2009 or 10, he testified she was incapacitated. And yet we have the Seventh Amendment on September 14th of 2012. Look at Billy's conduct there. What does the case law say? Going to the judge's error on case law, not the jury's, but the case law says... How do we judge, for example, testamentary capacity? What are the things that we look at? And I'm just going to find it here. We look at the reasonableness of the property disposition, the conduct of the testator within a reasonable time around July 26, and expert testimony. Well, the expert testimony, we'll start with that, was that Ms. Darkenwald, retrospectively, the expert said she had moderate dementia. Well, she had moderate dementia at the Eighth Amendment on July 26, 2013. She also had it on September 14, 2012. What changed? Ask Mr. Mergens, what changed where she went from totally able to amend her trust to not? And ironically, if the theory is right, this is where the jury's verdict has to be logical. And if it's not, the court has to step in and correct it. In that Seventh Amendment, compare it to the Sixth Amendment, and if you look in our addendum, we show a flow chart between the Sixth and the Seventh. She actually adds John and the grandchildren and all the other grandchildren into the residual beneficiary of the trust. And so if she's doing that, she does other rational things. She takes out the lineal descendants of Gil Sr. because she says those are too distant. She decides to change charitable giving. Those are very rational, logical acts for which she deliberated. Also, they make a big deal about Mr. Davis. Well, Mr. Davis was meeting with her before those changes. So was he right on capacity and undue influence there, but suddenly wrong on the later amendment? And we have to ask, what changed? You have to look at the entire record. There's no evidence that Billy Darkenwald suddenly had a stroke, suddenly magically became more undue influenced. In fact, on undue influence, Casey Darkenwald and Tanya Darkenwald testify that they were able to see Billy Darkenwald almost into 2013 when this actual amendment happened. Tom wasn't isolating. What happened is the litigation, the massive arbitration, did not settle. John decided to depose his mother, and that was the straw that broke the camel's back. And she comes back to Mr. Davis and says, I've thought about this a long time. My son John has taken too much. He's got 6 to 7 times the net worth of all his other siblings. He's had enough, and I'm making this decision. That's what happened. So we have to look at the whole fabric of the case, and that's where the judge has a gatekeeping function.
I'm struggling here because what I'm hearing you do, correct me if I'm wrong, but what I'm hearing you do is re-argue the facts of the case. And we're not, as you mentioned, we're only an error-correcting court. We're not a retrial court. And what I've heard you primarily argue are the specific facts of this case. So I'm going to ask the question that Judge Bryan asks is, what is the case law, what is the rule of law that has been violated here?
Well, let's go to the evidentiary question, which is admitting the bank statement. Evidence, which we feel the court abused its discretion in allowing that in because it created an unfairly prejudicial situation against my client that allowed Casey Darkenwald to persuade by illegitimate means. So that's definitely one of our concerns. But going more broadly.
Do you concede that evidence would have been, let's say that the only question was undue influence?
That was relevant to?
Well, relevant is I think, an oversimplification. Yep. If the objection was under 403, then it's not just a relevancy, but you're comparing under the 403 test, probative value and prejudicial effect. So if it was just about undue influence, are you conceding that was proper?
No, I'm not conceding, Your Honor, because I think it went too far. Certainly that was the main issue that it was used for. Because Billy was the primary beneficiary of her trust, primary beneficiary of her husband's trust. She was allowed to spend the money that flowed to her as she wished. There's no dispute that these were commingled bank accounts, but the fundamental issue is it confused the jury, misled the jury, and that goes to a specific error of law, Your Honor, is that Rule 403, in our view, was not applied properly. In fact, and we cited in our addendum, the district court, in a prior related case in the Darkenwald matter, ruled that Casey Darkenwald and John Darkenwald did not have standing to challenge Billy's personal transactions while she was alive. So that very definitely was an error of law. And then more broadly, the application of Rule 50 and Rule 59, in our view, is an error of law because you still have to apply that law, those rules of civil procedure. They say if a verdict is contrary to the rubric of Minnesota law, you have to fix it. So even, you know, if the jury makes findings of fact, but they make no sense on the entire record relative to case law that says, you know, when you meet with your lawyer, when there's no medical evidence at the time contemporaneously that shows you're in the throes of dementia, let's look at some other facts. We have a contemporaneous.
Well, but she was in the throes of dementia at the time of the signing of the will. The question, I think, is what level of dementia did she have at that time, right?
Your Honor, there's no dispute. Both experts say she had moderate dementia. But that's precisely why this case is so important, because as the baby boomers age, people need to amend wills precisely when they're in moderate dementia. As Your Honor knows, you can have moments of lucidity during a given month where you have enough capacity to amend a will, and then you can actually have a setback. And so that's why you would want to amend a will at the moderate dementia stage before you get to that severe stage where everyone agrees you can't do it.
So, counsel, out of the cases that you're relying on to suggest that we should reverse this jury's verdict, in which of those cases did an appellate court reverse for the reasons that you're citing, that the jury's findings are contrary to the evidence?
Unfortunately, Your Honor,
I looked for that.
I did too.
Okay. You'd be asking us to do a first time.
Yeah, no, that's why this is such an important case for a couple reasons. I see my time's almost out, but let me finish answering your question, which is, number one, these cases so often come up as bench trials, not jury trials. Secondly, they most...
But we don't reverse bench trials very often either,
no, I
correct?
Understand. Yeah, I recognize that.
Right.
But this is a unique, important case. And then finally, so many of these are decided on summary judgment that we got to look at those facts. And I see my time is up, Your Honors. So with that, I will reserve my 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Michael Mergens. I'm here on behalf of respondent Casey Darkenwald. At its core, this is exactly what Your Honors picked up on the questions. This is a jury verdict. This is a jury verdict with a special verdict where they were asked two very specific questions that they answered. This was a case that was presided on by a judge who is an exceptionally experienced trial judge who's been dealing with this case since 2012. He is incredibly aware of the facts of this case. He did not fail to do his duty as gatekeeper. He fully understood his duty as gatekeeper. He agreed with the jury. And that's basically what we're at here is, as you pointed out, what is the law? What is the law that this jury verdict is contrary to? Because when I read the cases, as you pointed out, what every one of them do is say there's substantial evidence in the record to support either the jury or the district court's decision below. That's all that they stand for. There's nothing more remarkable than that. What appellant is trying to do is say, these cases set up a bright line rule where if you fall on this side of the line, you have to rule that there was capacity. If you fall on this side of the line, only can you rule if that's capacity. And that's not what any of the case law says.
You'd agree that judgment as a matter of law, motion for that, is a proper way to address a situation where the evidence doesn't support the verdict.
I would agree 100%, and that's what was done here. And Judge Tenney said, no, I agree. There was evidence there to support this ruling. The jury was instructed, as they should have been, here are all the factors that you consider for mental capacity. Here are all the factors that you consider for undue influence. They went back. They considered all of them. When we went through our closing argument, we walked through factor by factor and said, here's the evidence that supports this factor. Here's the evidence that supports this factor. It's not just moderate dementia. It's all of the evidence that came into this trial. There's 7 days worth of testimony, 60 plus exhibits, 10 different witnesses. This
counsel,
jury,
did you have to prevail on both of your theories in order to prevail in the case?
No, either one. We prevail on either one, and the will is invalidated.
Argument below, I just didn't see it in the order denying judgment as a matter of law.
It did not make the order that it's a harmless error.
It's a matter of law in Minnesota, but I was just wondering, I didn't see that.
We did not because I did not feel that it was wrong on either case.
You won both issues, so I can see why you didn't make the argument, but it would have been an approach you could have taken. Is that right, that the Eighth Amendment should have been overturned for either undue influence or lack of capacity, right?
Absolutely correct, Your Honor, and that is as equally true as perhaps even more true here. The appellant has the burden of showing not only an error, but that it's a harmless, that it is not a harmless error, that would have resulted in a change below. And that's sort of when we get into the whole bank evidence, right? So we're now trying to say, well, the evidence was clearly probative. It clearly had value to showing why there was undue influence and that Thomas Darkenwald benefited from his influence of his grandmother. So then the question is, does it unfairly outweigh the probative value? And the answer is no. The judge, right, who has been sitting on this case for 6+ years, ran that analysis, and it's his discretion. He has to have abused that discretion.
Was there an instruction given to the jury that they should consider this evidence only as it relates to undue influence, as opposed to how it might relate to incapacity?
I would have to look up. I don't recall that there was a lot of instructions during the course of this case, but they were clearly instructed on what the elements were of each case. And I think the other thing that you have to look at as well, if you go back and you look through the closing argument, On our closing argument, there were, I think mine was more than 10 pages of testimony. There's two paragraphs that talk about the bank statements. It was a factor.
Right, but I think the argument isn't so much that those statements had prejudicial value as much as it is that those statements could have had could have confused the jury and in that way been prejudicial. So my questions are more about what did you or the court do to make sure that there was no confusion. And it's apparent from the court's order denying the objection that part of what the court relied on was testimony to clarify that. So do you think that was sufficient?
Thank you, Your Honor. If you go back and look at the trial transcript, there are multiple pages between Tom Darkenwald as his counsel where they tried to explain this bucket theory of the commingled bank account, that one bucket was the GMD trust, the next bucket was the BVD trust, and the third bucket was Billy personally. They had all of that explanation. The jury certainly could have chosen to follow that case, and we don't really know if they even considered this as a factor at all. But what we do know is the jury has the right to view credibility of all of the witnesses. And they saw what happened to Tom Darkenwald when he was cross-examined and asked about the ATM withdrawals and how it was that his grandma was authorizing them when he was downtown at a bar at 1 o'clock in the morning making a second withdrawal at the same time. They heard Dim Tavis talk about if there's going to be ATM withdrawals by a trustee, there should be at least a one-page document that says he's authorized to do it. They heard Tim Davis testify he would never recommend a trustee write checks out to cash. They heard Casey Darkenwald testify in all the time that they managed the accounts, they never did ATM withdrawals, they never did checks made out to cash. So what we have is Tom Darkenwald on the stand saying, Grandma told me to do it. And then we have a whole lot of circumstantial evidence that says, no, she didn't. And so there's massive amounts of cash that are disappearing in checks made out to cash signed by Tom Darkenwald or checks made out to Tom Darkenwald signed by Tom Darkenwald.
So, counsel, that evidence arguably shows that Tom abused his duties as a trustee.
Correct.
If we just accept the version that you just gave us. How does it establish undue influence? Because many cases have occurred in the past. We can find them in Northwest Reporter documenting trustees who have done similar things.
Sure.
And they those cases have come before us as a breach of the trustee's duties, not undue influence. So.
Yes. And I think that is a separate question
And it's an issue that wasn't in front of this jury, wasn't right? I mean, they weren't making the determination as to whether Tom breached his duties.
Correct. So if you look at Casey's testimony, one of the things that he said is the reason he brought this case is because of the decision that Mr. Anderson pointed out that said when Billy was alive, they were contingent beneficiaries and they didn't have standing. So in order to get standing to challenge the expenditures of the money, we have to first set aside the Eighth Amendment. They have to be beneficiaries to challenge the actions of the trustee as a breach of fiduciary duty. So in that regard, it wasn't before the court because it couldn't be. But
getting back to, I mean, your argument just now and Judge Bradfoll's question shows that evidence of what he might be doing at a bar in downtown at 1 o'clock in the morning, if you're offering the evidence and your argument against the 403 objection is that it goes to undue influence, and your argument just a minute ago had nothing to do with undue influence, how do you defend the judge's decision to admit that?
Sure. So I think there are a couple things, right? So the fact that it's damaging for Tom Darkenwald does not mean it's prejudicial. The fact that it makes him look bad that he is taking money out of his trust account for his own personal... No, I understand,
yeah.
But I'm getting to the answer. So the question, right, is why is it... probative to a question of undue influence. And if you look at the case law, right, it says here are six factors that you should consider. They are not exclusive. You should look at the evidence and surrounding in its totality. One of the things that we had the right to explain is here is his benefit. Here is how he financially benefits. If you look at Dr. Orr, when he was questioned about it, he was specifically asked if the trustee, the influencer, is taking personal benefit, getting personal financial benefit from his influence, is that a factor that you would consider? And he said, yes. That clearly makes the issue about what's going on in this checking account relative to the question of undue influence. And that also gets around to it's not the only factor, right? It's not even identified in the instructions of what the jury should consider.
So setting aside the bank statements, what's your other evidence of undue influence?
Well, so if you look at the both of the medical experts, right, they were all asked. So Dr. Orr tried to say on direct examination, just trust me, I put it all into a magic box, it comes out on the other side, and I tell you there wasn't undue influence, you don't need to worry about what happened in the magic box. On cross-examination, we went through. Was this factor present? Yes. Is she highly susceptible to influence? Yes. Was she isolated? Yes. Through each one of the six factors, and he agreed with them. Dr. Orr testified they were all present. Each of the factors had supporting evidence that was as much from their witnesses as it was from our witnesses. And so that's why what you really have is a case where they're trying to say, well, we're not challenging that there's insufficiency of evidence. We're challenging that it's contrary to law. And I still haven't heard what law it is that it's contrary to. And I think on the other issue here that we've got to talk about is the bank statement evidence. This is a case where admitting it had to be so wrong that it was an abuse of discretion for the judge that has been presiding over this dispute for 6+ years to have been wrong. He had to make a call on that balancing scale between probative and prejudice. Does the probative value of bank statement evidence outweigh the prejudice? He concluded that it did. And their burden is to prove that was an abuse of discretion for him to do so. And all they've done is said, well, it confused the jury because they didn't understand that it was Billy's money and she wanted it to be spent. You know the problem? There's no evidence that Billy wanted it to be spent. There's clear evidence at the top of the funnel that they talk about that it came in as trust money. This was all money that came out of an arbitration, hundreds of thousands of dollars. And then it filters down, and then all of a sudden there's ATM withdrawals and checks made out to cash, but there's no connection that Billy said,
so
I want that.
The isolation, the evidence you had of Billy's isolation with Tom.
Yeah.
So I mean, obviously he lived in the home, and we're familiar with the basic facts. But it seemed as though there was only the one incident that you offered evidence of, the flowers with the granddaughter not being allowed entrance into the home.
Well,
was there more than that?
I think there's also expert testimony from both experts that they agreed that she was isolated. Dr. Orr actually testified he wasn't aware that she was isolated in a rural farmhouse and that was an additional consideration for him that he would have to think about. He wouldn't say how that would change his opinion. But I think you cannot underestimate the fact that Billy K. Darkenwald, Billy Jr., testified that when she tried to go to the house, her grandmother, who had always loved her, said that she couldn't let her in, right? And then called her honey, as she always did, showed no animosity toward her. And then when Billy Kay called Tom to say, why can't I see my grandma? Tom's answer at first was, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know what you're talking about. And then it was, maybe your dad shouldn't have sued me. Then Tom basically admitted that he was in the house at the time, saying, why did you have to knock on the door so loud? What that shows is someone who had nothing to do with the arbitration, someone who had nothing to do with this other than being Casey's sister and John's daughter, was excluded from seeing her grandmother for no reason whatsoever, and not at the choice of her grandmother.
So that's one incident then. What else is there to show isolation?
Well, I think the simple fact that she is 93 years old, right, was not at the time able to travel by herself. She lived in a farmhouse that was exclusively, Tom lived in the house with her. I mean, that is more than sufficient evidence for the jury to conclude that she was, in fact, isolated.
Just because somebody is living at home and isn't mobile doesn't necessarily mean that they're isolated. Yes, you have that one incident where the younger Billy tried to see her, but is there other information in the record that other people tried to see her, other family members tried to see her, other friends tried to see her, and they were excluded?
Yes. John was not allowed, Casey was not allowed, Tonya was not allowed, Aaron was not allowed. They were not allowed to see her. Now, they will try to testify that it was Billy's decision. Our evidence was that it was Tom's decision. based primarily on Billy Kay, but then that becomes a fact question, right? There is evidence for the jury to conclude, yes, she was isolated, and they did. And that's really the job of this court, is if there's evidence that supports the jury's verdict, you don't touch it.
I'd like to switch gears unless there are other questions on that point. Your time's running low. I wanted to give you an opportunity to address the jury instruction challenge.
Sure. I think the jury instruction is pretty straight and pretty clear, right? If you look at the jury instructions, it is not enough to challenge a jury instruction and get a reversal on jury instruction to say the judge should have done more. The judge...
It depends on what was left out that the judge should have done. I mean, I'm not...
Correct. So
what,
if you look
about
at...
this challenge do you think...
What we're talking about is whether or not the judge included language that it has to show that they were essentially a mere puppet. The judge took these sieve jigs out of the companion handbook and used them almost to the word. We made some minor edits between counsel. But so now what the appellant is asking you to do is go back to trial judge and say, if you rely on the sieve jigs, which are a correct and accurate statement of the law, you're committing error. That's a pretty big leap, in my opinion.
So the mere puppet language isn't in the sieve jigs? Is that what
you're saying? It is not in the sieve jigs. But what is in the sieve jigs is the statement that comes right out of case law. Undue influence is an influence that defeats the free will of the testator and results in the replacement of the testator's desires with the influenced desires. When undue influence is proven to affect the provisions of a person's will, trust, or amendment, such document, the affected provision of the document is invalid. For undue influence to exist, not only must influence have been, in fact, exerted, but such influence at the time the will, trust, or such document is made must operate with such dominant and pervasive force. I see my time is up.
Go ahead.
That the will of the person exercising it is substituted for the will of the testator, whereby the resulting written document expresses the intent and purpose of the influencer, not that of the testator. That's a verbatim quote of the instruction that the judge gave. It doesn't say mere puppet, but it sure says the same thing. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Let me start, Judge Bryan, with your question last. The jury instructions, I think, are important, especially this mere puppet language, because, as we know, trying to figure out what undue influence is kind of this gestalt thing in the air, right? And it's such a visceral image that the undue influencer is the puppeteer pulling the levers. So had the jury heard that as part of the law, now the jury has to say, you know, was Tom the man behind the curtain for 3 hours doing Billy's deposition? Was Tom the man behind the curtain in 4 meetings that he wasn't even present at when Tim Davis, a 40-year experienced trust and estates attorney, was meeting with Billy alone? Was Tom the puppeteer that was preventing Billy from seeing people, as their own witnesses admit they were able to see Billy until 2013, even though Casey testified that Tom was allegedly undue influencing all the way back to 2006. So it is a very important instruction. I think the presumption instructions are important too, because it's kind of where's the starting point to get to something we haven't talked about at all, which is the heightened evidentiary standard of clear and convincing evidence, which means that the race starts at a different point potentially in the juror's mind. Because my time is short, I want to now talk next about Judge Bradfold's question, because it really gets to the core of what the prejudice was and what the error of law is, which your honors are very concerned about, clearly. And it does really relate to this fact. This case became putting Tom on trial for alleged breaches of how he ran the trust, and not about a very focused issue, which is on July 26, 2013, was Billy Darkenwald incapacitated, and was she undue influence, the puppet on a string, to manipulate, to disinherit John on that day? And when you look at ATM transactions, you look at checks written to cash, they have very little nexus to that date. And importantly, I understand Mr. Mergen's complaint or concern about the Catch-22 that he has to try.
Well, how do they not have a nexus to that date? Because we're not looking at the date in isolation, particularly with undue influence. We're looking, as you mentioned earlier, the circumstances surrounding that. And it seems to me that that is, at a minimum, it's relevant.
Well, I would agree with Your Honor, and that's, I guess, to my point that the Seventh Amendment, if the theory is to have logic and this jury verdict has logic, one would say the disinheritance should have occurred at the Seventh Amendment or even back in the Sixth, which occurred in 2007. And this is where the conflating of evidence is really important. I understand, I was just about to say, that Mr. Mergen's asserts he's got this catch-22. He needs to bring this case so he has standing so he can get to the alleged breach of trust argument. But the issue is that Tom did not have a duty to account for whether Billy went to Target and bought her food and had a newspaper. And Billy was this person of the Great Depression, and there's no doubt she paid cash to a lot of family members to take care of her because she didn't want to be in assisted living. And if you think about it financially, it's pretty brilliant. Rather than pay Wellstead $6,000 a month, pay your family members $6,000 a month. Fact that they chose to pay cash, they chose to pay cash. All of you can go to the ATM and take cash out.
Right, and I didn't read the entire transcript, but I'm assuming that was part of the argument that was made at trial, right?
The arguments were definitely made, Your Honor, absolutely. And it goes to this question, though, of at what point, you got to look at Rule 403 and misleading the jury and what becomes substantial prejudice, and when are you persuading by impermissible means? And Mr. Mergen's is
counsel,
right.
Counsel, I guess if the bank statement evidence was the only evidence offered, your position might have some merit. We still struggle with the hurdle that 403 balancing decisions are usually made by the district court, not by three appellate judges who aren't there hearing the witnesses. And you've already conceded that the bank statements are at least relevant circumstances.
Well,
so I guess what I would like you to do is talk about some of the other evidence.
Sure.
Of undue influence. So there is isolation, not just of the granddaughter, but of other grandchildren. Now, you argue that that was Billy's choice, not a decision by Tom. That was heard by the jury. And then we also have Billy's statements during her deposition. So she makes a number of statements, and you've cited some of them to us that show that she did have some understanding of what was going on. But we also have statements made by her, such as when asked whether someone had told her that John was taking money, she indicated that she was not getting the amount she was supposed to get from Riverbend. And then when asked if someone told her that, whose name does she mention? She mentions Tom.
Well, I see my time is up, so can I answer your question, Your Honor?
Please.
Obviously, Tom is her caregiver, her trustee, her power of attorney. She answers truthfully because he was diligently in consultation with her pursuing the arbitration to recover years of money that Gil Sr. and Billy felt John had denied them of, and as you know in the record, recovered a $1.2 million judgment on Billy's behalf. And that's, again, antithetical to the notion that Tom is trying to cheat his grandmother. He's looking out for his grandmother so she can live in her home until almost 95 and her death. And so I would just close with Your Honors, we don't just rubber stamp jury verdicts. Rule 50 and 59 are there for a reason. It is to give the trial court and this court an opportunity to correct errors. And it's our view that there were errors here. The court should reverse and enter judgment for Tom and or at least grant a new trial with instructions on remand as to what can be admitted into the record. So it's not Tom on trial, but looking at Billy's state of mind and the date in question. Thank you so much, Your Honors.
Thank you both very much. We will take the case under advisement and issue an opinion within the required timeline.